So, welcome to another exciting episode of The Word of the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namasami. So, the last time which I gave the class, we just got to the three characteristics of existence. Just having finished with some of the five senses and the dependency of consciousness, and now we come to the classical Buddhist description of the three characteristics of existence, which is anicca, dukkha, anatta. So, in other words, I'll just leave it anicca for the moment, and then suffering and no self. And of course, this is taken from the suttas, and the reason why I compiled them in this way was following on from something which Venerable Nyanatiloka did over 100 years ago, added a few extra paragraphs, quotations from the suttas, upgraded the quotations, took away many of the repetitions in order to make sure that these word of the Buddha flowed more smoothly and the translations were more accurate. So now, on the left-hand side, you can see the sources of these quotations. They have some like AN3136. That is Anguttara Nikaya in the threes, number 136, the Sutta 136. So all of these are just noted there where this all comes from. So if anyone wishes to check, they're welcome to. But more importantly is that the translations are a little bit more precise. They are not word for word translations. They are phrase by phrase translation. And I did mention this when I started this series, teaching it here, that the unit of language is a phrase or a sentence. It's never a word. And if you make word by word translations, that you'll find you get into so much difficulty. And of course, the one I usually mention, the famous one in Australia, or not England, not Australia, but in English, if you try and translate that it was raining cats and dogs, then you get into a lot of trouble if you translate that as that it rained little pooches and little sort of pussycats. It's not what it means. It's idioms, and so many words are used not specifically in that by themselves. It's the words around them, the sentence, the phrase, that is the unit of language. So that's what I have done here. Instead of translating word for word, translate sentence by sentence, phrase by phrase. So anyway, here we go, the three characteristics of existence. All phenomena that arise from a cause do not persist. That's anicca. They come into being, and one day, sooner or later, they must pass away. All phenomena that arise from a cause do not persist. All phenomena that arise from a cause are suffering. They arise, and then they have to disappear again. And if you try and find something which arises and then disappears, which is happy, you cannot find that. Even though they say in the heavenly worlds, even though they're having so much happiness for long periods of time, the very fact that one day that happiness will fade, that itself is a cause of suffering. It's not going to last. And all phenomena are without a permanent essence. So this is what the Buddha was saying. If you look in any phenomena which exists in this world, you cannot find anything in it, a little part which is permanent, which is equivalent to a soul, an indivisible essence of you. And if there are any physicists here, I've often mentioned this, but it's an interesting observation which does deserve more investigation. In science, in physics, it was proposed that an atom, I think it could have been Aristotle, that an atom was the indivisible, it's a Greek word, indivisible. I think that's what it meant. Not being able to act means not tama or something. It's an indivisible part of nature. It's like a permanent thing, an atom which cannot be split up, from which this world is made. And of course we all know that it was Rutherford who split the atom. But we also have something which it comes out much better in Sanskrit, the atma, atom, atma, which is the soul, indivisible, which is what it really means. So, we always thought there was an indivisible part of this conscious process called us. But it was must be about 2,400 years before Rutherford, the Buddha split the atma. In other words, saw that this thing which we assume to be a soul is just made of parts, each one coming and going, anicca, dukkha, anatta. There is not a permanent essence. What do you think, this is from the Samyutta Nikaya, to carry on, what do you think does form, the body, persist or disintegrate? It's not just your body, it's your car, it is the hall of Dhammaloka Center in Perth, it is the equipment which we use here. Does it disintegrate or does it persist? It disintegrates. And you just ask the people organizing this, is that suffering that sometimes it doesn't work? You bet it is suffering when it disintegrates. Is what disintegrates is suffering and subject to change fit to be regarded thus? This is mine, this I am. This is a permanent essence. If it really was yours, if you had ownership of it, then you should be able to protect it, keep it, guard it. So it was there forever. That's what being mine means. This I am, this is who you are. This is always fading away, going wrong, disintegrating, suffering. Can you really, is that what an identity, a self, a soul really means? And is it your permanent essence? Instead of calling it a soul or a self, I preferred the translation, even though it's clunky, of permanent essence. The essence just shows this is what's the essential part of you, the building block, like the idea of an atom. But it has to be permanent, something which doesn't change, otherwise what's inside that something which changes? So, what do you think? Does the body persist, disintegrate, disintegrates? If what disintegrates, suffering or happiness, suffering, is what disintegrates, is suffering and subject to change, fit to be regarded thus? This is mine, this I am, this is a permanent essence. No, venerable sir. Does experience, this is Vedana, persist or disappear? We're going now through what's called the five khandhas, the five components of existence. Experience. I know that sometimes that's called feeling, But the English word feeling just has a very broad meaning, and it doesn't necessarily fit with how the word Vedana, experience, is used in the word of the Buddha, the sutras. And I much prefer the word experience to translate that term. Yes, experience does have three types, pleasurable, unpleasurable, or somewhere in between. But what we're talking about there is this thing which most people know as our experience. There's another word for it, the experience of senses, the experience of our mind, the experiences of life. This is experience. That's what Vedana means. Does experience persist or disappear? Does perception persist or disappear? That's perception being the third of the five khandhas, components of existence. Does will stay the same or come, go and alter? Sometimes we call that, do you change your mind? It's not really changing your mind, but changing what you want to do, how you want to do it. You know, this thing which we call choice, volition, will, that is always changeable. And it's the will which is the main part of the fourth component of existence, sankhara. Sankhara basically means will. And lastly, consciousness is constant or changing. And I think one of the other translations here you may not be used to, instead of calling the fifth component of existence consciousness, the Buddha would always explain consciousness as being of six different types. Sight consciousness, hearing consciousness, smell, taste, feeling, bodily, and mental consciousness. Totally different, each one. And so six different types of consciousness. That's why it's not a typo. When I wrote down here, our consciousnesses, constant or changing, is on purpose. Six different types of consciousness. Always changing, Venerable Sir, is what is always changing, suffering or happiness? Suffering, Venerable Sir, is what is inconsistent, so inconstant, suffering and subject to change, fit to be regarded thus. This is mine, this I am, this is a permanent essence. No, Venerable Sir. And this was a part of the second teaching which the Buddha gave after he was enlightened. The first teaching was the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, turning of the wheel, at the end of which one of his disciples became a stream winner. That was Kondanya. Art was known as Anya Kondanya. Kondanya, who knows? And after that, the Buddha taught the Anattalakkhana Sutta, characteristics of non-self. And this is part of the Anattalakkhana Sutta. Our consciousness, will, perception, experience, the body and other stuff, are these constant or changing? You see the anicca part, constant, always changing, then you see there can't be happiness. If you want some happiness in the world, it has to be permanent, it has to be there forever, something you can rely upon. What's the point of being happy for 24 hours of the day, and the next 24 hours you're unhappy? Is that what you really want to end up with? So it's not yours, it's suffering, it's changing, it's not fit to be regarded as this is mine, this am I, this is my permanent essence. Remember, the Buddha was talking to people who had spent their whole life seeking for truth, seeking to understand, you know, who they were, and you know, what was their essential self. Things which change, which come and go, can't be the essential part of them. Well, so what are we made up of? What is our essential core? And I found there's nothing there. And anyway, for the five components of existence, the Buddha gave these similes. Suppose that this river Ganges, you know, using local rivers, was carrying along a great lump of foam. A person with good sight would inspect and carefully investigate it. And it would appear to them to be void, hollow, and empty. For what substance could one find in a mere lump of foam? So too, whatever kind of form, body, there is, whether past, future, or present, one's own or others, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, you inspect and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to you to be void, empty, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in form? Suppose it were raining, and big raindrops are falling, and a water bubble arises and bursts on the surface of the water. A person with good sight would inspect and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to them to be void, hollow, and momentary. For what permanence could there be with a water bubble? So too, whatever kind of experience there is, whether past, future, or present, one's own or others, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, you inspect and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to you to be void, empty, momentary. For can anything constant be found in experience? Suppose that in the last month of the hot season, around noon, a shimmering mirage appears. A person with good sight would inspect and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to them to be void, hollow, and illusory. For what reality could there be in a mirage? So too, whatever kind of perception there is, whether past, future, or present, one's own or others, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, you inspect and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to you to be void, empty, illusory. For what reality could there be in perception? Suppose a person needing hardwood would take a chainsaw and enter a forest. There they would see the trunk of a large banana tree, straight, fresh, without a fruit bud core. They would cut it down at the roots, cut off the crown, and unroll the coil. As they unroll the coil, they would not even find softwood, let alone hardwood. A person with good sight would inspect and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to them to be void, hollow, and without a solid core. For what solidity could there be in the center of a banana tree? So too, whatever kind of will there is, whether past, future, or present, one's own or others, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, you inspect it and carefully investigate it. As you investigate them, it appears to you to be void, empty, and hollow. For what core essence could there be in volition? Suppose that a magician would perform a trick at a crossroads. A person with good eyesight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to them to be void, hollow, and deceptive. For what truth could there be in a magical illusion? So too, whatever kind of consciousness there is, whether past, future, or present, one's own or others, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, you inspect and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to you to be void, empty, and deceptive. For what authenticity could there be in consciousness? Is. So these are the, from the word of the Buddha, the five components of existence, the five khandhas, body and other stuff, tables and iPads, stuff basically, and experience, perceptions, will, and consciousnesses. And the Buddha compared each one of them, made these synonyms for them, metaphors for them, comparing the body to a lump of foam floating on the river. Experience, the plop, a raindrop on a puddle, so momentary. Perception, like being a mirage. How do you, you're seeing something, but we interpret it, and we usually don't get it accurately correct. And we have will, the sankhara, as a banana tree with no solidity to it. I must admit that I cannot really put this in the book here because it's not the word of the Buddha, but it's the word of the great monk of Venerable Gunaratana, usually Bhanteji he's called these days. And he used to say that the sankhara, the will, he said it's like an onion. Because when you peel the onion, you find there's nothing solid in it. You peel it and peel it and peel it until you go right into the center and there's nothing there. But the nice thing about the onion, if you look at the spelling of the word O-N-I-O-N, it goes on and on with an I in the center. That is your will. And if you peel it, you cry, that's called suffering, and there's nothing in it when you look deep inside of it. So an onion is a much, I would say, a better simile than the way it's used these days than the banana tree, but that's what the Buddha said, the banana tree, so we'll leave it as the banana tree. What by analysing these things, the point is to look very deeply into them and see there's nothing there, nothing permanent, nothing solid. And you may also notice that sometimes people say, oh well yeah, we can understand this. There's nothing solid in these six consciousnesses, there's nothing solid in will, there's nothing solid in perception, nothing solid in experience, nothing solid in the body. What about, it must be something else. Something outside of the five components of existence. And what's the reason why the Buddha kept on saying that whatever kind of consciousness, whatever kind of this, whatever kind of that, past, future or present, one's own or others, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, the whole lot. There's nothing solid in there. Nothing permanent. Nothing which a wise person could say, this is me, this is mine, this is my permanent essence. And now to carry on. One who seeks pleasure in the body form seeks only irritation. One who seeks irritation, I say, is not free from suffering. Personally, that's a powerful statement because I don't know what your age is. There's many people here older than me. I am 68 now, coming into my 69th year. Even now, my body is irritating. And it's not going to get less irritating. It's going to get more irritating if you can do less. So this body, yeah, it has its pleasures, but it has its aches and pains as well. It's irritating. So if you seek pleasure in the body, you just seek only irritation. So irritation is not really extreme pain, but it's still, it's not good enough. One who seeks irritation, I say, is not freed from suffering. But what happens is that sometimes you can get into these really good meditations. So you're sitting here and, oh, it's just really hot, it's itchy, there's mosquitoes on you, you're sick, and you get into this meditation, you go inside, so beyond your body. And when you go beyond your body, so you can't feel the mosquitoes sucking your blood, you can't feel the fevers, you can't feel aches and pains, oh, it's so nice. Basically, that's nimittas, and especially the first jhana. Because in that state, what you're separated from is your body.
really alive, very aware, but no feelings, and that's bliss. Why is it bliss? That's one of the questions you always ask afterwards. Wow, that was just so good. Why? Because something which was a gross irritation, a pain, a whole heap of suffering is not there. You're free. What's missing? It's my body. No one knows just how painful and how irritating this body is until it disappears. And you're very, very awake. It's nice. That's why even the Buddha said that, and towards this, when he was getting very old, he said the only time he can sort of get beyond this really achy, painy, old body was going into deep meditation. And then the body vanished. Oh, that's nice. So, the body is irritating. One who seeks gratification in experiences seeks only disappointment. Have you ever noticed that? That you go to the place, you're really looking forward to it, and it's never lives up to how it should be. Even like Jhana Grove, great meditation center. It's just so nice, but the doors creak. Oh, the aircon's not working. Oh, there's always something wrong. Oh, there's ants in your room. These were just reading the comments after the last retreat. There's always something which is not quite right. So, I read this one of my stories. I can't resist my stories. And this guy, he was born in London and really smart, and his parents were really wealthy. So he thought, it's about time I get married. I'm going to marry just the most perfect girl in the whole world. I'm wealthy, got good parents, good education. Why not? So he found this really gorgeous woman who worked as a supermodel. And he thought, oh, this is the one, she's just gorgeous. And went out with her a couple of times and then decided, no, it's not going to work. Because she couldn't cook. So he went over to need someone who can cook, was also gorgeous. So he went over to Paris. There he found a really gorgeous woman, even more pretty than the one he met in England. And she owned her own restaurant. And, oh, she was an amazing cook. So he went out with her for a few weeks, and then it all fell apart because she was stupid. All she knew was cooking and clothes, nothing else. And couldn't hold a conversation about anything. Hadn't even finished school, so he dumped her. And then he came to Perth in Australia. And there he married the most beautiful woman you could imagine. And she owned a whole string of restaurants. And she had a PhD from Cambridge, a PhD from Harvard, and a PhD from the Sorbonne. Oh, she was absolutely brilliant, gorgeous, and a great cook. And he couldn't marry her either, because she was looking for the perfect guy. Welcome to the world. So anyone who seeks gratification experiences will only find disappointment. Have you ever noticed sometimes you get so close to perfection, and then you actually never actually get there? You can see it, you can smell it, you can almost touch it, but when you go towards it, it goes away from you. That's life. So anyone who seeks gratification experiences seeks only disappointment. One who seeks disappointment, I say, is not free from suffering. I say here is the Buddha. Because this is what the Buddha was saying. One who seeks reality in perceptions seeks only illusions. One who seeks for illusions, I say, is not free from suffering. So you want to find the truth in your perceptions. what you're perceiving, is it true? These are mirages. What you're actually seeing is a real experience, but we're adding and subtracting from what we're actually experiencing. For those of you who don't know, the best simile for that, which many of you have been on my retreats listening to my talks a long time, was the flower pot experiment. Remember that one? Some do. Okay. This was my mate who was a close friend and student of Stephen Hawking's, a physicist, as a Bernard Carr. And he was also the president of the Psychic Research Society in London. And him and his mates did this experiment. The experiment where this great physicist in London claimed he'd found the secret of levitation. And he was going to demonstrate in Imperial College London how to levitate a flower pot. And he had all of his friends, all of these old professors. And if you've ever seen any old professors in London, or actually anywhere else in the world, they are just so conservative. He got them to come because they were friends. And he came into the lecture room carrying a flower pot, put it on the table, and said, get the cameras going, you can take photographs if you want, we have ultraviolet cameras, infrared cameras, I want to make sure that if it works, we have a record of this, this is going to be groundbreaking, this is going to change the way we look at science, I know it works, but I need your help. And that's where he asked everyone to start chanting, Om, simple, just to get the atmosphere right. And he got all these old professors going, Om, Om, Om. And as they were going, Om, Om, the flower pot rose into the air. It actually worked. They levitated a flower pot. Wow. And they photographed it, videoed it. It was real. That moved up in the air. And afterwards, they asked the professors and the trained observers, experimental physicists, what do you think of that? And many of them said, think of what? The flower pot rising in the air. And they said, it never rose in the air. They said it was on the table all the time. It didn't even move, they said. But look at the photographs. Oh, that's been faked. And that was the point of the experiment they were looking for. Because those of you who know what was happening, underneath that big laboratory bench was a huge electromagnet. And when they decided to levitate the flower pot, they just turned on the magnet. But anyone here knows that when you turn on a machine with a very heavy electrical current, you can hear it humming. So getting them to go om, om, om was just a hide. The fact it was electricity passing through something. But nevertheless, the point was that they never saw, and they never perceived the flower pot lifting off the table. And these were trained scientists. Can we trust our perception? Or is it some perceptions are blocked? Some are amplified out of all proportion. That is the point of the Buddha's saying. One who seeks reality in perceptions seeks only illusions. One who seeks for illusions, I say, is not freed from suffering. One who seeks contentment in volition seeks only frustration. I like the idea of contentment here. If you want to be peaceful, happy, content is where you have an end of volitions. So when you seek contentment and volition, you seek only frustration. What do you want? Are you going to get that? Try harder. Come on, put some effort into it. Go for it. You can do it. Go on. What happens? Frustration. One who seeks contempt and volition in will seeks only frustration. Now, of course, many of you who are meditators might get the message that those who seek peace, stillness, deep meditation from volition, come on, concentrate, sit still, stop thinking, do this, do that, catch the nimitta, enter jhana. If you seek contentment from volition, you will only seek for suffering. One who seeks frustration, I say, is not freed from suffering. Wanting is the cause of suffering. It's Buddha's first teaching, almost. So one who seeks eternity in consciousness seeks only the affliction of more rebirth. Why do you want an eternal conscious being? The essence of you, who you really are, this perfect essential soul. One who seeks eternity in consciousness seeks only the affliction of more rebirth. I haven't seen many movies, but one movie which I was asked to see was Groundhog Day. Do you remember Groundhog Day? Where the guy kept on being reborn the same morning, and after about a million rebirths, every morning he got so fed up with it. He tried to die, but he couldn't get out of the system by dying. You just get reborn that morning before. It's an interesting idea. But you know what happened? I thought it was a really good idea, good movie. But what happened in the end? He fell in love. And then he woke up the next day. Falling in love is not the way to get rid of rebirth. It's not the way to end suffering. But nevertheless, it's the way to get people to go to movies. So anyway, if you seek eternity in consciousness, you're only seeking for the affliction of more rebirth. The one who seeks rebirth, I say, is not freed from suffering. So that's, the Buddha was pretty heavy on the five components of existence, saying each one of these has their faults. They're not happy. And if you seek more consciousness, more will, more perception, more experience, more body, you're seeking more suffering. And why this laughter, why this joy when it's ever burning, shrouded all about in gloom when you look for the light? Look at this attention demanding body. A mass of irritations, constantly needing support, prone to illness, with nothing stable or lasting. This body gets worn out, so fragile, an incubator for disease. When life ends in death, this disappointing body dissolves. Okay, so any questions here before we go on to the next part, the three warnings? Are you all enlightened? You don't object? Okay, let's go on to the three warnings. But my friend, says the Buddha, didn't you ever see a man or a woman 80 years of age or more, frail, sickly, struggling to walk even with a walking frame, with many a complaint, strength gone, with forced teeth, with white hair or a wig, with wrinkled skins and blotched limbs and forgetful? And just as a passing comment, if you ever compare that to what the Buddha said about old age, he used different words. But I've added a few words, taken away a few words. The Buddha never mentioned like a walking frame. They didn't have walking frames in those days. They just had a stick. They didn't actually say about forgetful. I just added that in there. Simply because what we're doing here is we're taking what the Buddha said as a phrase, not just word for word, but actually adding into it. You may have actually noticed that earlier, just like with a simile for sankhara or will, as a banana tree, imagine a man going into a forest with a chainsaw. You know they didn't have chainsaws in the time of the Buddha. But putting it in there just was how a person today would describe what the Buddha was trying to describe. My friend, didn't occur to you, an intelligent and mature person, I too am subject to old age. I am not exempt from old age. So let me now do good karma while I still can by body, speech and mind. But my friend, didn't you ever see a man or woman sick, moaning, gravely ill, bedridden, incontinent? My friend, didn't occur to you, an intelligent and mature person, I too am subject to illness. I am not exempt from illness. Let me now do good karma while I still can by body, speech and mind. But my friend, didn't you ever see among human beings a dead man or woman in a coffin about to be cremated or buried? My friend, didn't occur to you, an intelligent and mature person, I too am subject to death. I am not exempt from death. Let me now do good karma while I still can by body, speech and mind. So that's called the three warnings: old age, sickness and death. And of course that was there to remind people that, you know, those things are coming to each one of us sooner or later. And I know people always say this, I say this, that, you know, time flies by so quickly. Just on Friday before I came here, there was two young women came, the Erica and Herbert. And I remember those, when they first came to the temple, they were little kids, about 6 or 7 years of age. And that was 36 years ago. How much have I grown old? That time went so fast. Another 36 years. Will I be here? Will you be here? Time goes very fast. Yes, I admit now I'm over the hill. Certainly at 68. But one thing I've noticed when you get over the hill, the more you are over the hill, the more you pick up speed going down to the bottom. It gets faster and faster. So, you know these things. And so you just make sure that while you've got the energy, while you've got whatever health you've got, while you've got the time, make sure you use it wisely. Samsara. Now this is really means that the samsara is like the almost like perpetual wandering. The idea of going over here, going over there, just wandering back and forth, never really stopping, never really having a home, just wandering from one experience to another experience, one meditation, one teaching to another teaching, just always wandering. And this samsara is without a beginning. A first point is not found of beings roaming and wandering on, blinded by delusion and addicted to wanting. Now straight away here you have to point out that this is just a very rare that there here is a path, a philosophical path, a religious path, which doesn't say that this world started at a certain time. There's no creation here. There's no beginning. It goes on and on and on, round and round, forever. A samsara without a beginning. A first point is not found of beings roaming and wandering on. And that's one of the reasons why when, you know, I won't go into detail here, but when I started talking about too many people are flat timers, like flat earth. Flat earth, you go so far in one direction and then you fall off the edge, like people thought 400, 500 years ago. Flat time. You go back further in time, you fall off the edge, the beginning. You go too far in the future and you fall off the edge, the Armageddon, the end of time. The whole idea of like time having a beginning and an end is just philosophically just so gross and causes so many problems. The idea like the planet Earth curved, round. no beginning, no end. That, I say, is cool. The fact the universe is also round. Curved space, curved earth, curved time. So we don't need a beginning. What do you think? Oh no, I should actually just comment on blinded by delusion and addicted to wanting. That blinded by delusion. In other words, that's what delusion does. You feel that over there, over somewhere else, that you can get what you want. That happiness is there for you. You can get it. You can own it. You can even sometimes people market it. Blinded by delusion and addicted to wanting. It's said elsewhere by the Buddha. I think it comes up later on in these talks of my Word of the Buddha series. Even wanting is a pleasure. Not getting what you want, or not getting what you want. It's the whole process of wanting. We're addicted to wanting something. Even if we don't need anything. We just, I want to want something today. Just that sort of irritation of wanting something, of going, even though we don't need to go anywhere. It's like those people who are in a house and they've cleaned up their room already, they decide to clean it up again and clean it again. They don't need to. They just like cleaning. They like doing stuff. They like wanting. And I was always interested, why is it that even wanting can be pleasurable? And I've mentioned this when I teach people at, say, Jhana Grove retreats. Over there, your room is comfortable. You don't need anything more in your room. You don't have to pay for the electricity or the water. You don't have to pay rent. You don't have to pay anything. So you don't need to make any money. The food is there just provided for you, really good food. You don't need to go and decide what you're going to eat today. You don't need to go and order your lunch. It's just there. The teachings are just there. I don't force anybody to come. They can go and sleep all day. They can go for walks. There is nothing you need to do. Everything is provided. You don't need to want anything. But that doesn't stop people from wanting something. And that's fascinating. You take all the need to want and people still want. Because they want to want. It's not the object of wanting. It's just wanting. We're so addicted to it in our world. The idea of sitting down and letting go of all wanting is scary. What, you mean I'm going to sit here and just not want anything? But. Try it. And if you can, it gets scary. Because if you don't want anything, then you can't think. Thinking is the language of wanting. Silence is the language of contentment. The opposite. And when there's no thinking, when there's no wanting, it's, you've disappeared. You've vanished. You, as you're used to, is gone. Where have I gone? That's why people like wanting. Because when you want something, you are. When you don't want something, man, that's not wrong. When there's no wanting, then you're vanishing. Oh, anyway, I love that stuff. You're addicted to wanting. So the idea of stopping wanting, whoa, that's lovely. What do you think, which is more? A stream of tears that you have wept as you roamed and wandered on through your many lives, weeping and wailing because of enjoying the disagreeable and not getting what you want. Which is greater, those streams of tears or the water in all the great oceans? And the Buddha said, for a long time you've experienced grief through the death of a loved one or a dear friend or the loss of reputation or wealth. As you've experienced this, weeping and wailing because of enduring despair and not getting what you want, the stream of tears that you have wept is more than the water in all the great oceans, said the Buddha. Now you know why the water in the oceans is salty. Because your tears are salty. Oh, come on. That's a lot of tears. Ooh. For a long time. Okay. Which do you think is more, the streams of blood that you have shed when you were beheaded? Just that. As you roamed and wandered on through this long course. This or the water in all the great oceans. For a long time you've been arrested as murderers. You. Nicholas, murderer. Not in this life, you're really good, but in many other lives. Burglars. Were you a burglar before? Maybe not this life, but before. Adulterers. I better not look at anybody and say names. Which do you think is more, the streams of blood you have shed when you're beheaded because you were caught as beheaded, as murderers, burglars, adulterers, and when you were beheaded, the stream of blood that you shed is greater than the water in all the great oceans. So a lot of lives you've lived. For what reason? Because this samsara is without a beginning. The first point is not discerned of beings who, blinded by delusion and addicted to wanting, are journeying through this round of rebirth and death. It's the Buddha talking, saying it's a lot of rebirths. Even just one person, wandering on through their many lives, blinded by delusion and addicted to wanting, would leave behind a stack of bones. A heap of bones, a mass of bones, as large as Mount Everest. They said like Mount Sumeru, but I changed that word to Everest, simply because you know Everest where it is, and it's a big mountain. They would leave behind a stack of bones as large as Mount Everest, if there was someone to collect them all, and what is collected would not perish. For what reason? Because this samsara is without a beginning. For such a long time you've experienced suffering, agony and disaster, and swell the cemeteries with your bones from your many lives. It is enough to experience revulsion towards all volitional formations, will. Enough to let go of the cause of more birth. Enough to be liberated from samsara. All your bones, and your blood, and your tears. Is this going to be your last life? Or do you want some more? That's called motivation, sort of. What we got? Oh, that's just the truth of suffering. Okay, any questions or comments so far? Yeah. I think I might understand what you're asking, but people listening in from overseas would not understand. So would you please repeat that into the microphone so that those people listening
I'll try
in another place.
When we pass over, when we die, pass over or die, it states that we all everything separates, divides, and disperses and such. So there's nothing consistently, solidly there, like a soul or whatever, so that soul can be reborn again as such. This is my understanding. I don't know whether that's correct or not. If that's the case, then how does it all composite together in a rebirth, in
okay.
another life as such?
So there is, I thought it was a very nice description which the Buddha gave of, he called a stream of consciousnesses, a stream, like a river, a body of water which flows. It's never the same, any two moments. The old simile that you look at the water while you're standing on a bridge. You look at it today, you look at it tomorrow, you look at it the next day, and it looks pretty similar, but you know that there's no molecule of water which was there yesterday, which is there today, which is going to be there tomorrow. It's all flows. It appears to be the same, but you look more closely and there's no permanent essence there. It's always flowing through. It's called a stream of consciousness. But nevertheless, that stream of consciousness, you can see it's in a certain place. That river is between the two banks. Yeah, when there is a flood or a drought, it can change slightly, but it's confined by its karma. Your stream of consciousness flows this way, flows that way. You can change it, but sometimes it's recognizable who you were yesterday and who you were today. And lastly, it's as it flows from one place to another. It can go fast, lots of will, lots of desire, lots of craving. It can go slower. So all of these things with your stream of consciousness, there are some things which can be added, can be subtracted. And it carries with it some of the karma from the past. So because of that, that's the stream of consciousness, the vijnana, the consciousness which goes from life to life. And the people who remember their previous lives, or the spaces between those previous lives. And those people who have what these days we call near-death experiences, which is basically they die, but they're brought back to life again. And there's so many common experiences which they have. When they die, they're separating, the physical idea is being separated from their body. And having a form, physical form, which is so similar to the last physical form which they had in their previous life. The ghost, the spirit, the apparition. And I still remember this one lovely story of one of the followers who was a builder, developer more like, and one of his friends, a builder over in Kalgoorlie, got cancer. And he came to see me just to get some blessing. His friend lived in Perth, flew the builder over and met him at the airport, took him to Bodhinyana Monastery, made an appointment to see me, had a nice hour conversation with him, gave him some meditation teachings and stuff. But, you know, he was a typical Australian builder. He came in his Australian national dress, singlet, shorts, and a pair of thongs. Really nice guy, very respectful, but that's what he liked wearing. And so, after he died a few weeks later, and after he died, the person over here in Perth, he came to see me, he said, "Oh, that night before," he said, "last night, he was woken up by his wife nudging him, and he turned around and told his wife off, and he found his wife was fast asleep. It wasn't her, he turned around and it was this guy, his friend, a ghost. But what really surprised him was his friend, this Australian builder, was wearing a suit and a polka dot bow tie. There were spots on it. And he said, straight away he turned to his wife and said, "Hey look, he's here." And of course when he turned around again, the apparition had disappeared. And it was really... people do strange things with ghosts. Both of them got up and searched the whole house looking for him. Of course he's gone by that time. But anyway, he came to tell me. He said, "Really, very clear vision of the one who died. He said what was weird was the clothes he was wearing. So that's when I told him, said, tonight or this afternoon, ring up the widow, just have a conversation. How are you doing? Anything I can do for you? Oh no, by the way, what did you dress your husband in the coffin? Because it was a closed coffin, so he couldn't see. And he came the next day, actually rang that night. He said, Ajambam, Ajambam, Ajambam. I asked the wife, and he was wearing a suit with a bow tie. And he said, I've never seen him wear that in his life, and I was one of his close friends. And I said, oh yeah, yeah. I bought that suit and that bow tie for him a couple of years ago. He refused to wear it. But I bought it, and he can't argue with me now, he's dead. So I dressed him up in the suit. So, be careful what you dress up as when you're in your coffin. Someone might see you. Or the other story of this gentleman who was so rich that when he died, he told his wife, so put me in my coffin naked, no clothes at all. Why? I know you've always been one of the reasons you don't want to waste money in business, but we can afford to put you on something. He said, no, that's my order. My last will. Make it in my coffin. Why? Look, he said, I know all the things which I did to make money, and some of them are terrible things. I know where I'm going, and down there you don't need any clothes. It's too hot. And so, she followed his wishes, put him naked in the coffin. And a few days later, he came back as a ghost, a naked ghost. And he asked her, he said, hey darling, have you still got some old clothes there, like the old golfing jumper and maybe some trousers? So what do you want those for? Didn't you go down to hell? He said, oh yeah, I went down to hell, okay, but don't you know, there's so many rich people in hell, they've installed air conditioning. Okay, come on.
So then in other words, you get different streams.
There's different streams, yeah.
Yeah.
Different streams. And the stream which you identify carries your karma, goes and gets reborn again.
Okay. Thank you.
And has a lot of the characteristics of who you were before. That's why sometimes the rebirth happens pretty quickly. What was it, that story of the guy in Sydney? That he was a Buddhist. In his family, his auntie was a businesswoman, very successful, never got married. So when she died, that she divided up the inheritance. And this guy, the Buddhist, got really little amount, just a few old cups and plates and stuff. Most of the big expensive stuff went to some other people in his family. So anyway, that's life. But anyway, he told me that just after his auntie died, maybe about a year, his wife gave birth to a girl. And that girl, when she started to speak, he came in, he told me, into his room with a cup of coffee in one of his auntie's old cups. Hey, daddy, that's my cup, give me my cup. So many memories of the past life this daughter had. It was his auntie from the past. And even little things, his auntie being a businesswoman in Sydney, never liked paying tax, never ever. And one day they were passing this on the billboard, I think GST was coming in or something. So this big advertisement, GST from the government or something. And this little girl, about 2 or 3 years of age, Daddy, what does tax mean? And she said, oh, well, if you have any pocket money or earn anything, you have to give something to the government. And this little 2 or 3 year old turned around and said, I'm not giving any of my money to the government. Even then, that some of her characteristics from the past had carried on into this little 3 or 4 year old girl. They tend to disappear, those characteristics, after 6 or 7, 8 years. Sometimes, but not always. Okay. Does it mean you can choose your body when you get reborn? Sometimes you can choose your parents. I mean your gender or your Sometimes people do, but sometimes they make mistakes. Sometimes it's very hard. Who are you going to choose? Sometimes we get attracted to certain characters and you get a bit repelled from other characters, but that's as much as you can possibly do. You can't totally choose.
Talking about suffering and wanting, sometimes I visit historical places and I could feel the suffering and maybe unfulfilled wanting of maybe ghosts. How would we sort of like lighten that suffering and wanting?
If you see someone coming here, like often happens, and you have to talk with them, just a bit of kindness. And when a person's kind and you receive kindness, you relax, you open up. And there's a good opportunity you may understand some Dhamma. So you start off with kindness. And after kindness, to allow, if it's a ghost, a spirit, so you know you're passed away now. Remember all of your good karma. But if they can't remember their good karma, remember that story which I told you, that when I did my first brick wall, two bricks were crooked, and that's all I could see. It's just like you've all done some bad karma, and if that's all you can see, you want to destroy your happiness, like I wanted to destroy that wall. They see to some nice, kind person, say, can't you see the 998 good bricks in the wall? When I saw those 998 good bricks, I realized that's what you do even when you die. You've all done some bad stuff in your life. So now you don't look at that. Look at all the beautiful stuff you've done. All the times you've been kind and generous and helped other people, been selfless. All those wonderful times. Wow. That's what we remember when we die. We train ourselves for that. So you tell the ghost, it's lots of good stuff you've done. And if you haven't done any good stuff, I can do some good stuff for you in your name. And you share the good karma. Make them rejoice that people actually care for you. That's wonderful. So that's a good thing. So just, well, there's a few people here. How you make people happy. I'm going to read this out. Oh no, that's the wrong one. I'll find it in the next. There we go. Because some of you who go to our Armadale group, we know about our group in Armadale, that every year they make a little collection for some gift cards for Christmas, because they also, Armadale is a low economic area, and we have a little meditation group there, and they get some Coles Myer gift cards for the children and the mothers in these these special hostels where they're safe for people, refugees. That's right, refugees. So they just sent a letter to me, just I'm distributing around, to the meditation group. Thank you so much for all your support and donations over the years. All that you do is so very much appreciated, especially at Christmas time with the very generous donations of the Coles Myer gift cards. I think $25 on each card. But this year, every woman and child at our annual Christmas party got a gift card. These families often come in with nothing and have been through so much trauma. These cards enable them to go out and spoil and pamper themselves with $25 on something special just for them. The feedback we got from the families was very positive. Lots of thank yous, lots of quote, I can't believe there are people out there who care and are so generous. So from all of our clients and staff, thank you. Little things like that just actually show just how there's so much goodness out there which people need to know more of. And all the ghosts. Did you get uplifted when you heard that? I got uplifted when I got this. A simple letter. That's why I printed it out. I want to pass it around. go see if we can get uplifted. Hey, there's goodness in the world. And it might remind you of some of the things you did over Christmas or New Year's time or something for others. So that's how you deal with even ghosts. Uplift them. Give them some good karma. It's not their karma, but you're sharing it with them. Which means that they'll get so uplifted, they'll just get a nice rebirth instead of being in a ghost realm. So that's nice stuff. Okay. Shall we continue on or finish off for this evening? Today? One more? Who wants me to continue on for another 15 minutes? Who wants it in time to go? Who's fast asleep? Okay, I'll go for another 10 minutes, but not too long. So, the noble truth of the origin of suffering. So, you know there's suffering, but how do we overcome it? It's caused by the threefold wanting. Now, this is the noble truth of the origin of suffering. It is this wanting which leads to rebirth, accompanied by enjoyment and desire, seeking delight now here and now there. That is the wanting related to the five senses, wanting to be, wanting not to be. Oh, that's it, the three ones. Related to the five senses, wanting to be and wanting not to be. All types of wanting. Now, for those of you who look at the usual translation, people get stuck in the same old translation of craving. Craving is far too hard a form of wanting, too intense to really be a good translation of what's called here tanha. Tanha. This means like thirst. And are you thirsty? Actually, I'm thirsty now. I'm not dying of thirst, but you know, a glass of water. That's nice. That was wanting. So it's not craving. It's a much lesser, softer form of wanting, which the Buddha is talking about here. And it's wanting related to the five senses, wanting to see beautiful things, wanting to hear great sounds or music or things which are very dear to you. Smells, tastes. What are you going to have for dinner this evening? Have you already figured out what you're going to eat tonight? I have. Nothing. I'm not, I don't eat other monks eat lollies, but I don't eat lollies. My cup of chocolate sometimes. But not lollies. And I don't figure out what I want, they just come. They just put down in front of me. So we don't have a menu at Monastery. Should we get a menu? No. So we don't have one. So it's a wanting related to the five senses, and the wanting even to feel. To feel physical comfort. Are you comfortable here? Should we turn up the air conditioners, make it a bit cooler? I'm really hot up here. What about you down there? Are you hot? Are you cold? You know that wanting causes trouble. If you had your own air conditioner, remember each one of you had your own air conditioner, and you pointed it at the air conditioner, there'd be a fight. Sometimes that happens at monasteries sometimes. One of the monks or novices get hold of the air conditioner, and then they hide it afterwards so that no one can change. We're just a bunch of kids. But it's when it's wanting, there's suffering. It's never good enough. It's never perfect, your body. So that's why wanting. And what was that lovely saying? When you want something else, you cannot enjoy what you already have. I love that saying. That's basically summarized what the Buddha's saying here. When you want something more, something else, something different, you can't enjoy and appreciate what you already have. It's not good enough. You want more. So, when I want to improve Dhammaloka Center, improve the hall, I can't enjoy what I already have here. So remember that. It's a good teaching. And which leads to rebirth. Oh yeah. And wanting to be. That's even stronger than related to the five senses. That was the best example of that story of that was when you had this guru from the 60s called Baba Ram Dass. He was really hairy, but he was actually a psychologist, a professor of psychology from Harvard, who got kicked out for experimenting with, I think, LSD or something. He got kicked out, went to India, became a guru, came back, and one of his disciples, a woman in New York, her father was really sick in hospital, had some terrible disease which the doctors couldn't fix, in almost constant pain. And so the daughter thought, well, maybe my teacher could maybe help. So she came in. She was not, you know, properly dressed. But he came in really long hair, hippie beads and a caftan, you know, the usual uniform which gurus had to wear in those days. And as soon as her father saw this weirdo coming into the hospital, he said, get him out of here, I don't want to see this crazy fellow. So he wouldn't even listen to him. But then as she was talking to her husband, this Baba Ram Dass started to give this father a foot massage without permission, a reflexology. And as he was pressing the right places in the foot, for the first time in days, all the pain went in this gentleman's body. It was actually working, it was actually doing something, taking away this almost constant pain. And when the pain started to disappear, the father just turned to him and said, get away from my feet, leave my feet alone. He'd rather have his pain and understanding than just have the pain removed and admit he was wrong. Actually, that's nothing to do with wanting to be. But anyway, the wanting to be is, sorry, that is where if a person is almost disappearing, even if people are about to die, they'd rather have pain and exist in pain. But as long as they're here, they're being, they don't know what happens after they die. So the wanting related to five senses, wanting pleasure in, or at least comfort in any part of the body, even if they can't get that comfort, they'd rather have the suffering in the body than feel they're not going to be at all. In other words, wanting to be is a very, very strong wanting. And many of you, that can come up when you are meditating and your body's disappearing, so you don't have any pain in the body, no even happiness in the body. The body is just content, it's disappearing. But you won't let it disappear, because if the body disappears, it's like you're not there. You're disappearing, you're vanishing. And that disappearance, vanishing of the body, any part which you really are so attached to and used to, when that starts to vanish, it's very scary. Why? Because what you think you are, that being, is vanishing. We'd rather be and suffer than not be at all. So, wanting to be. And last one, wanting not to be, it's annihilation. That's almost like, I've had enough of samsara, I want to get out of here. I don't want to be here. And that annihilation, again, that's another type of wanting. The Buddha described that as a dog chasing its own tail. It can never actually catch its own tail. To me, I prefer the words in Oliver Twist, Charles Dickens, which said it's like trying to eat your own head. Can you eat your own head? So it cannot be done, just trying to destroy, wanting to destroy yourself. Never happens. Because the wanting is there. If you want to cease, become fully enlightened and disappear. It's the wanting which has to cease. So once the wanting starts to calm down, once the wanting becomes stilled, then there's the opportunity for freedom. As long as there's any wanting there, wanting to be or wanting not to be, then there is life. And more life. On and on and on, round and round and round. Any comments, questions? So, do you want to carry on? Or do you want to stop? Any of those two wantings causes suffering. So I'm going to end your suffering for you. That's enough for tonight, today. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. So we can now do the balance thing, and then we can go and finish off any questions you come and ask afterwards.